Birth to who? Of her husband. Udara Karmanaha. Who was so liberal. Natva. Offering obeisances. Divistan. Situated in the sky. Tridashan. The 30 million demigods. Trihi. Three times. Paritya. Circumambulating. Vivesha. Entered. Vanim. The fire. Dhyayati. While thinking of. Bhartri. Of her husband. Pado. The two lotus feet. It's a translation. After this, the queen executed the necessary funerary functions and offered oblations of water. After bathing in the river, she offered obeisances to various demigods situated in the sky in the different planetary systems. She then circumambulated the fire, and while thinking of the lotus feet of her husband, entered its flames. So purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. The entrance of a chaste wife into the flames of the pyre of her dead husband is known as Saha Gamana, which means dying with the husband. This system of Saha Gamana has been practiced in Vedic civilization from time immemorial. Even after the British period in India, this practice was rigidly observed, but soon it degraded to the point that even when the wife was not strong enough to enter the fire of her dead husband, the relatives would force her to enter. Thus this practice had to be stopped. But even today there are still some solitary cases where a wife will voluntarily enter the fire and die with her husband. Even after 1940, we personally knew of a chaste wife who died in this way. So, Vidaya Kurjam Ridhani Jalaputa Tatpurkam Barturudar Kamanaga Natwadivistam Tridasham Tri Paracha Vivesha Vanim Jayati Vatri Padhao. So, Om Gana Timiranda Shah Vinanda Janash Lapaya Chachur of Medikam Gena Tvasmai Shigurve Namaha. So I'm not going to give a class describing how the wife should jump into the funeral pyre of the husband. And I'm not going to advocate this. But there is a tradition like that. And it was because, not simply because the wife didn't know who was going to make money for her after she died, or who was going to protect her after she died. It was because there was so much devotion and love between the wife and husband in those days that she voluntarily did that. I mean, she couldn't envision living without the husband. And in the previous class, we described some of the arrangements that were made, so the wife was feeling like that in relationship to the husband, the husband was feeling like that in relationship to the wife. We were talking about earlier marriages, arranged marriages, before the girl would, I've probably talked about this, before the girl would reach puberty. And we mentioned Lord Ram's marriage. Does anyone remember what I said about Sita, how old she was?
She was 6 years old.
6 years old.
6 years, very old.
Yes, 6 years old. Now, and Ram was 12. So it's not that they, as I mentioned before, it's not that they lived with each other at that age. But she knew, like Prabhupada described, she knew, this is my husband. So when she grew up, you know, reached puberty, it wasn't like, eeny, meeny, miny, mo. You ever hear that saying before? Catch a husband by the toe, if he hollers, don't let him go. It wasn't exactly like that. It was that she was thinking, this is my husband. It was just like when you're born, you know, someone is your mother, someone is your father. Of course, nowadays, with divorce and all these other things, you may have say this. Anyway, you may have two mothers or two fathers or several fathers. If your mother happens to believe in serial polygamy. It's interesting in society, this one thing, is that we have polygamy in our society. Here in Slovenia, there's polygamy all over the place. Did you know that? It's called serial polygamy. There's parallel and serial polygamy. Parallel means at the same time. And serial means one after the other. But it's still polygamy. Because the word polygamy means many wives. And polyandry, but does anyone know what polyandry means? Many husbands. So there's serial polyandry and serial polygamy. So it hasn't been really outlawed in society. It's still going on. But the interesting, not that I'm proposing that we have polygamous relations of any type, but the interesting thing about parallel polygamy is that when the husband accepts more than one wife at the same time, is that the husband would take responsibility for them all. It's actually better than serial polygamy, right? Because in serial polygamy, you just dump one off and you get another one. But in parallel polygamy, you've taken responsibility. I mean, Krishna was engaged in parallel polygamy. 16,108 wives. And each and every one, Prabhupada said, had their palace and 10 sons like that. And it was, and he was able to divide himself up so they didn't have to take numbers. You can imagine like each wife like pulling a number out. My number is 15,000, you know, whatever. And I have to wait that many days until I can see my husband again. It wasn't like that. They were all satisfied. And then you have one king. I mean, this king, Chitraketu, does anyone remember how many wives he had?
10 million.
10 million wives. Wow. But because he wasn't able to divide himself up so well, and only one wife had a son, there was trouble. Because the 9,999,999 wives became upset with the one wife who had little baby Harshashoka. And they poisoned him. So basically in Kali Yuga, there should be one wife and one husband. Because it's not practical anymore. So none of the men should think of two wives, three wives, four wives. Prabhupada said there was one devotee who was proposing to have, that's an interesting word, proposing, but he was making proposals of Prabhupada, not of marrying. But he's making a proposal to have another wife. And Prabhupada said, our business is to reduce sex life and your business is to increase. So therefore, don't come to the temple. You know, basically told him not to stay in the temple at least. So anyway, so this chastity between husband and wife, I mean, it was just very, very strong and there were many arrangements made for it. And the stability of the marriage institution and society keeps the whole society is stable. When marriages break up, society becomes unstable. So let's not just talk about marriage because I don't want to belabor the point. But society, a Vedic society, was based upon all sorts of loyalty-based relationships. It was a hierarchical society. Now for those of you who don't know what the word hierarchical means, that means there's lower, a little higher, a little higher, a little higher, 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 at the top, because the top is Krishna in the Vedic society, the Varnashram society. So it was very much a hierarchical society, so you see in different relationships, not only between husband and wife, but between brothers, or between sons and fathers, or daughters and fathers, it was just, there was this system of obedience. And Krishna himself talks about this in the Gita, the 17th chapter. He talks about austerities of the body. Does anyone remember that? Of course, Plamana Maharaj is an old Gita memorized, so I'm not going to ask him. But the rest of you nice Vaishnavas and Vaishnavis, what are the austerities of the body? Does anyone remember?
Respect the superiors.
Like?
Father, mother, guru.
Brahmins, good. And also there's several other austerities of the body listed, but they're not applicable for this class. Does anyone remember the other austerities listed? You know, Maharaj told me, like, he went somewhere to preach, and he had a few days off, so he memorized the whole Bhagavad Gita. And then I saw him playing chess yesterday, and he said, "Do you want to play with me?" I said, "No." I don't like to get defeated. You know, four moves, you can defeat any opponent in chess. So, what are the other austerities of the body? Anyone remember? Cleanliness. Doing dandavats? No. Celibacy. Non-violence. Right? What did I leave one out?
Deva, Dvija, Guru, Pragya, Pujanam, Socham.
Cleanliness.
Arjava.
Religiosity.
Arjava.
Or is it honesty?
Simplicity.
Simplicity, that's right. So simplicity. Okay, so anyway, so these are the austerities. So the Vedic culture, based on the first part of this verse, you know, offering respects to one's superiors, is like that. It's very hierarchical. And in the Western culture, it sort of rubs us in the wrong way when we hear about this hierarchy, isn't it? Because, you know, basically we're all one, and nowadays the children call their parents by their name. They say, "Hey, Bob!" You know, instead of Mama Shri or
"Hey, you."
Mama Shri. "Hey, you." Yeah, I'll explain right about something about "Hey, you." That instead of Mata Shri or Pita Shri, like you see sometimes in these Hindi movies, like the Mahabharata or something like that, it's just, "Hey! Where was the food?" Like that. "Your duty is to give me food." So, it's not, in the Vedic system was so strict that you couldn't even use, in relationship to your superior, the familiar you. I mean, in many languages you have a formal you and a familiar you. Is the same thing in Slovenian? Or?
Yes.
In English you don't. Everything's you.
Thou.
That, well, it's not used anymore. Thou. I don't think I've ever used that in my whole life. Thou hast. That's old English. But modern English is just basically, there's just one you. But in most other languages that I know about, like Spanish, you know, there's a familiar you and a formal you. So let me tell a story about this. This is from the Mahabharata. Once upon a time, there was Arjuna, which I think all of you have heard about. So Arjuna had promised during the war to defeat his enemy in a particular day, one day. He said, "I'm going to beat my enemy this day." Because, you know, the vow of the Kshatriya was considered very important. And he said, if I don't defeat this enemy, this is not the Jayadrath story, this is a different story. If I don't defeat my enemy this day, I'll kill myself. Oh, no, actually, that's not the story. Arjuna vowed, here's the actual story, sorry, that if anyone offended his Gandiva bow, he would kill that person. Yeah, that's the story. Okay, so he vowed, because he was very attached to this Gandiva bow. He actually went to Yudhisthira. He went to Yudhisthira, and Yudhisthira chastised him for not fighting properly or coming. Yudhisthira was a little injured, so Arjuna went to see Yudhisthira, and Yudhisthira said, why did you leave this battlefield? You know, what is the use of that Gandiva bow that you're so attached to? And then he thought, now someone's insulted my Gandiva bow, so I have to kill the person. Yeah, he actually took a vow to kill the person who insulted his Gandiva bow. So now I have to kill Yudhisthira Maharaj. So he was getting ready, and Krishna said, you know, that's not really the method you're supposed to employ. You can kill him by insulting him by using the familiar you. right? That's a story. So he used the you, the familiar. You this, you that. And that was actually such an insult. It was like killing. It was considered like killing. But then Arjuna felt so bad that he insulted Yudhisthira Maharaj like that, that he thought, now I have to kill myself because I have insulted Yudhisthira Maharaj. So he got ready to kill himself. And then Krishna said, no, that's not really what we want. Right in the middle of the battle of Kurukshetra, you know, it's not really my plan. So you should just brag about yourself. Yeah, that's the story. And then Arjuna started bragging. I'm the great Arjuna. I got this Gandhi Babo. I can defeat anybody. And that was considered like killing yourself, isn't it? It's interesting. Because that false ego, when you manifest your false ego and brag about yourself and proud about yourself, you're actually killing your real self. Because it's violence. Because Prabhupada described violence as something that impedes someone's spiritual progress, right? That was Prabhupada's definition of violence. I mean, of course, when we kill an animal, not we, but when someone kills an animal, it impedes their natural progress as they're going to go through the natural, what we call evolutionary cycle to a human being, eventually. So when we brag about ourselves, it impedes our spiritual progress. We say, look at what I did, how I dressed the beauty so nicely today. And you're not thinking of showing people how nice the beauties look, but how nice you are. Isn't that pujaris do that sometimes? Oh, what a nice class. You like my class today? Yeah. Actually, there's a statement that he who praises me is my enemy, and he who criticizes me is my friend. Of course, I don't need any more friends. I'd like some more enemies. So, anyway, getting back to the point, it's a very hierarchical society in the Vedic system, and we see that the son or the younger brother is willing to sacrifice everything for the older brother or for the father. I mean, there's another example I was thinking of. Grandfather Bhishma, before he became a grandfather, his father's name was Shantanu. And Shantanu had a habit of getting attached to different ladies. Anyway. So one time, he became attached to this fisherman's daughter, Satyavati. She actually wasn't a fisherman's daughter. She was really the daughter of the king of Vashu, but that's a different story. So anyway, so he became very attached to her. Actually, she was very attractive because she had previously given birth to Shiva Vyasadeva and been blessed with an aroma that would go for Yojana. That's like 8 or 10 miles. So she was called Ganda Yojana or something like that. The smell that went for 10 miles. Previously, she smelled like a fish. It's true. This is the story of Mahabharata. So anyway, so Shantanu saw her, and Shantanu fell in love. And he went to her father, and he said, you know, I'd like to marry your daughter. Even though she's a fisherman's daughter, you know, still, whatever, he was in love. And the father said, basically, you can't do this because, or at least I'm not going to permit it, because in this way, I want my daughter, if she gets married to you, her son to be the next king. And you've already promised Bhishma, your firstborn, from Ganga Devi, that he should be the king, so she can't get married to you. And so this Shantanu, he went into a deep depression at that point. We're talking about love the other day, right? And the brain scan, right? Remember that? So he went into such a deep depression, you know, he couldn't get out of bed, basically. And Bhishma, his son, asked the prime minister and the associates of the father, Now, why is my father in such a deep funk, as they say? Needs a depression. And they explain, because your father fell madly in love with this girl, and he's not able to have her. So, Bhishma, being a dutiful son, went to the fisherman and said, you know, my father would like to marry your daughter. And the fisherman said, well, these are the conditions. And Bhishma said, well, I vow to renounce my prince position. I vow that I won't take over the kingdom, and he can take over the kingdom, or the son of them. When my father gets married to Satyavati, he can become the next king. And then the fisherman said, but you may have a son, and then there'll be some sort of dispute there. And then he vowed something very heavy for a Kshatriya, Akhanda Brahmachari. Generally, you don't find Kshatriyas being Brahmacharis, isn't it? Because Kshatriyas are influenced by the mode of passion. And they're quite romantic chaps. the Kshatriya marriages, you know, the swine bar where they go and they have some competition. And they fight with their enemies, and then they smear the blood. That's the red dot on the forehead. Red dot on the reddish in the part of the hair, the wife's hair. They smear that on the wife's hair. And it's just like so romantic. Don't ask me what's romantic about blood in your hair, but or fighting. You know, a Brahmin is not really going to fight to get his wife. I'm going to say, you know, Krishna's arrangement, I can't get married to her, whatever. Take me out. You know, who cares anyway? It's too much trouble in any case. Is that how to do Brahmin's attitude? Yeah, Krishna doesn't want it. Hare Krishna. So, but in Kshatriya is it's like that. He's passionate. So anyway, for Bhishma to renounce this position and is even getting married and to remain celibate his whole life was something really big. But he did that to serve his father. It's wonderful. You know, that sort of dedication, devotion. And that's really the hierarchy. You know, maybe I'll tell one other story about this hierarchy. Actually, we'll talk about something about husbands and wives to encourage you married people. So, there was once upon a time, this is also another Mahabharata story. Satyabhama was asking Draupadi, how do you keep your husband satisfied? Do you use like tricks? You know, do you have some like mystical potions or herbs? Or whatever, you know, voodoo. She didn't say voodoo, obviously. But I'm just extrapolating on the story a little bit. Because she noticed that Draupadi was able to really keep her husband happy. And Satyabhama had this idea, because Satyabhama has this, she's left-handed wife. You know, there's left-handed wives of Krishna and right-handed wives. Right-handed wives are the submissive ones, like right-handed gopis like Srimati Radharani. Left-handed by like Srimati Radharani, right-handed Chandravali. Right. And so, you know, there's submissive wives and unsubmissive wives like Rukmini, she's submissive, and Satyabhama, she tends to nag Krishna, like when she wanted the Parijata flower. She said, you got it for Rukmini, I want a whole plant here. So Satyabhama asked Draupadi, you know, how could you keep your husband under control? And Draupadi answered, I did not employ any of these nefarious tricks to do that. What I do, this is a hint for all of you ladies who are married, is I wake up earlier than my husband's every morning. And I go to sleep after they go to sleep at night. Because none of your husbands should take what I'm saying in class and just like use it as to beat your wives. You know, this is what you're supposed to do like Draupadi. Because you're really not like five Pandavas. You're not like Yudhisthira, Arjuna, Nakula, Sahadeva, or even Bhimasena. You may eat like Bhim Sain, but but you're not like him in strength and heroism. So anyway, so she described that, and she says, you know, I just see to their needs, and in this way, they're very satisfied with me. And she, this way she was able to keep five husbands satisfied. Pretty good, isn't it? So anyway, so this is another instance of this hierarchical structure. One other instance, and then I'll get on to something else. Then there's the relationship of Lakshman with Lord Ramchandra. The Lord Ramchandra, of course, was the elder brother of Lakshman, and Lakshman had to follow whatever Lord Ramchandra said. And Lakshman remained awake during the whole time that they were in exile to guard Lord Ram and Sita. And he served his older brother just like a menial slave. In the same way, Lord Rama followed the order of his father when Dasarath didn't really want to exile him, but Dasarath asked him to be exiled for a certain period of time, being under the influence of Kaikeyi. So he was very dedicated to the order of his father. So anyway, so these are all different hierarchies and let's say practical means by which people act in those hierarchies in the Vedic culture. Now, I'm going to give it sort of an opposite understanding here. That these hierarchies, even in the Vedic culture, are not actually absolute. Because sometimes you will find overriding principles that go against the hierarchy. And those overriding principles are generally when Krishna tells devotees to do something, like in the case of the Bhagavad Gita. You have Krishna telling Arjuna to kill his guru. I mean, talk about reversal of the hierarchy, right? To kill his grandfather, to kill his cousin brothers, and some of which were actually, he didn't kill the Kuru, Duryodhan and his brothers. It was actually Bhim Sain who did that. But you have that sort of reversal where Krishna is actually asking Arjuna to go against this natural hierarchy in the Vedic system, and Arjuna, of course, is hesitating, wanting to take sannyas rather than do that. He said, you know, it's better to just renounce everything, better to die than to kill the guru and kill everyone else. But so Krishna, in that case, the natural hierarchy or the Vedic hierarchy can be, let's say, either disobeyed or disallowed or ignored, only in those cases. Or there's other cases of the Ramayana where you have Sugriva, who is instigating Lord Ram to kill his older brother, Bali, right? And because Bali had actually violated the norms, the dharmic norms, Bali had actually taken Sugriva's wife, Ruma, away and improperly kicked Sugriva out of the kingdom due to a misunderstanding. So therefore you have a reversal of the Vedic norms. Or, in the case of Vibhishan, this is another story for the of Vibhishan turning against his brother Ravana and helping Lord Ram kill Ravana. So there's a reversal of this normal Vedic norm. Or even you have Shukadeva Goswami preaching to the sages, you know, along with, of course, Maharaj Pariksit, and the sages were elder to him. So that's also a reversal of the Vedic norm. So sometimes it's difficult to understand what is the right norm, what is the right norm to follow. Although, under normal circumstances, we should be following this Vedic norm system of hierarchy. Now, what's the reason for that? What's the reason for having a hierarchy in society? I mean, isn't it just easier to say, you know, everything's one, we're all one, there's no older devotees, younger devotees, there's no, you know, there's no special respect that's afforded Prabhupada disciples. Well, the reason for following these norms, one big reason, of course, is that it keeps society in order. I mean, unless you have a hierarchy in society, society is very much disordered. It's like an anarchy at this particular point. And then society can't function well, and then ultimately you don't really have loving exchanges, because the hierarchy, although it may seem to be unnatural, facilitates loving exchanges, which is really, really interesting when you think about it, how something that appears to be just like an imposition in society can facilitate love. Because the people in the hierarchy are not simply serving those who are above them in the hierarchy out of a sense of duty, but ultimately they develop a sense of respect, and ultimately it comes to love. Like in the case of worshiping the Supreme Personality of God, who is at the top of the hierarchy, we do it out of a sense of duty in the beginning, but then, of course, that's Vaidhi Bhakti, following the rules and regulations, but ultimately love develops. It's like you practice in the beginning, and then by practice, you become more spontaneous, that's Raghunatha Bhakti, and then ultimately, it comes to the point of love. And the interesting thing is, when it comes to the point of love, that love controls the person who is higher on the hierarchy. Isn't that interesting? Just like in the Nectar of Devotion, six qualities of pure devotional service are described. Has anyone here read the Nectar of Devotion? No? Yeah. It's based on Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. What are the six qualities of pure, not love anymore. What are the six qualities of pure devotional service? First quality. What is the first quality?
Kreshabdi,
which means immediate relief from what? Yeah, distress. So what's the next one? Shubhata. What does that mean?
All auspiciousness.
Next one. Not Maharaj. He's the Vedas personified. You know. Shruti Mana.
He said one.
Oh yeah. What does that mean? Or as Prabhupada said, derives the conception of liberation. What's another one?
I know Sanskrit.
No, give me the Sanskrit, that's all.
Sudurlabha.
Okay, what is it? Sudurlabha. Like Adurlabha, Sudurlabha. What is Sudurlabha? Rarely achieved. Rarely achieved. Okay. What's another one?
Krishna Karshina.
What does that mean?
It's the only way to attract Krishna.
The only way to attract Krishna. And I think we left that one, didn't we?
Sundarananda Vishatma.
Yeah. Happiness.
It's unlimited happiness.
Unlimited happiness. So the one I wanted to mention was, it's the only means of attracting Krishna. Just like in the transcendental realm, you have Srimati Radharani and Krishna, and Radharani is serving Krishna. But one of her transcendental qualities is that she always keeps Krishna under her control, right? I mean, the ladies, they would always like to wrap their husbands around their little fingers. Right? Maybe not. So she always keeps Krishna under her control, but by her devotion. And a pure devotee of Krishna, working under the jurisdiction of Srimati Radharani, is also able to control Krishna by his or her devotion. Just like we have this instance when a pure devotee promises something, it's actually more valuable than when Krishna promises something. Is it true? Like Prabhupada said in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Kunteya Pratijanihi, Name Bhakta Pranashati. What does that mean? You? Who is Krishna talking? Arjuna. Kuntiya. Of some Kunti. Kunti. So my devotees will never perish. And Prabhupada explains that Krishna is asking Arjuna to say that. Because Krishna sometimes doesn't always do what he says. Whereas Krishna's devotee says something like, we have the instance where Prabhupada said, you know, chant 16 rounds, serve the Krishna conscious movement, follow regular principles and go back to Godhead, then Krishna's duty bound to follow him. Not so much duty bound, out of love. Krishna will comply with that, you understand? So that's really the point. So if we want to, or as Prabhupada said, we shouldn't try to see Krishna, we should try to have Krishna see us. In other words, manifest devotion for Krishna, so there's this hierarchy again. Manifest devotion for Krishna to such an extent that Krishna becomes controlled by that devotion. Of course, if you're thinking, I want to manifest devotion to control Krishna, that's not devotion, so that's a catch-22, as they say, isn't it? I want to be a pure devotee so I can control Krishna. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. Krishna, come under my control. Now. It doesn't work like that. Because when you get to the point of being a pure devotee, then it's something like you were looking for some broken pieces of glass. Isn't it? Like we have Dhruvamara saying. But I found a beautiful, wonderful gem. So in other words, then you don't want to control Krishna. But you control Krishna by your devotion. So this is the absolute hierarchy. And then in the spiritual world, when you begin to control Krishna by your devotion, at that point, you forget about the hierarchy. Right? Because then, you develop such an intimate relationship to Krishna, you can start to chastise it. Like Krishna enjoys more the chastisements of Mother Yashoda, when she's running with a stick during the Damodara Leela, then Krishna enjoys all the prayers of the personified Vedas, right? So it's interesting, that hierarchy, you start off with a hierarchy and after a while, you know, Krishna's just my buddy. Or Krishna's just my kid. And you have an intimate relationship in the spiritual world. But right now we're not on that level. I don't want any of you to approach Krishna like that. Like this Raghunandana, who was the son of Mukunda, he had that relationship with Krishna. He was approaching Mukunda. The physician asked his son, Raghunandana, take care of the deities. And Raghunandana, he actually started to berate the deities and say, you have to eat. You know, he offered a plate in front of them. He said, eat, 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 Krishna. And then Krishna actually got down and ate what was on his plate. So that's like an intimate relationship where the body can assume a superior position to Krishna, or Arjuna ordering Krishna. Krishna became a part of Sarathi. So that's something that's for the pure devotees. But right now we should observe the hierarchy, not only in relationship to Krishna, but in relationship to the different interactions we have in this world. Whether it's mother, father, guru, husband, son, whatever, a brother. These hierarchies are actually very important to keep society in order. So any questions or comments this time? All right, you didn't say anything about hierarchies?
The higher it is, the better it is.
The higher you are, the better it is? Yes, stay high forever, as Prabhupada said. In the material world, everyone wants to become the top man. Like there was that story that Prabhupada was talking at the Dynapon company to some salesman, and he said, Prabhupada asked, what's your goal in life? And the salesman had this whole stack of different business cards.
No, they put all when the businessmen walked in,
yeah,
present the Prabhupada, and they put their cards on the right table. The big guy puts the card
on top, right?
And everyone else down at the bottom. So he was the one who put his card was all the way down at the bottom.
Yeah, but then Prabhupada asked, what do you want to do? And then he took his card and put it on the top. Yeah. So, that's generally what we want to be. So, we want to be on top. But he who tries to take the topmost position in this world, he actually is the lowest. Like, someone who is a gopi bharata padakamala dasa 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 dasa, the more you're a servant of the Lord, a servant of a servant of a servant of the Lord, the more exalted it is. And the more you try to be Ishwara Hamahambogi, you know, the controller and big and everything like that, the more fallen you are. Now, I'll tell you one funny story. I think some of you have heard this story about the frog in the mud. You heard this story before? No. Once upon a time, I think you heard this story. Anyway, I'll tell it again. So there was a frog who had gotten a blessing from a sage that whatever you see, you'll be the king of. You'll be in charge, you'll be the boss. So he thought, you know, I want to see more and more and more. So at that time there weren't any skyscrapers around. So the only way he had to see more was to have all the frogs form a pyramid. You heard me tell this. Yeah. You know, frog pyramid, like 10 frogs, 9 frogs, 8 frogs, or whatever. Yeah, I mean, there were actually like 50 frogs, 49 frogs, 48 frogs. So they made a big pyramid of frogs so he could climb to the top and see more. Like you see in the circus, sometimes they make these human pyramids. So they made this pyramid. He was all the way on top. And he thought, I'm the king of the hill or whatever. And I can see everything. So he climbed all the way on the top to see everything, become the king of everything. That was the blessing he got from the sage. But when you get so high, with so many levels, the thing started wavering. Because they didn't have guy wires to hold the frog. So it started wavering back and forth, and finally the whole thing fell over, and the frog ended up with his head in the mud. So therefore he became king of the mud. That's the moral of the story. That if you try to be very high in this world, that's what you end up being, the king of the mud. But if you try to become a servant of a servant of a servant of the Lord, then you end up in an exalted position. Right? So, anyway, so there's nothing wrong with this hierarchy. It's just very nice, you know, having someone who's superior and someone who's superior to him. It gives a certain sense of security in society. So, any other questions? I'm not saying that we want to impose this on people, but it keeps society structured. And you find, actually, in traditional ashrams, there's always this sense of a hierarchy, you know, like who took sannyas early, who got initiated early. I mean, sometimes it gets a little far out. Like when I remember when Gaudiya Math he went to, they had to line up for prasadam, and if someone took sannyas 5 minutes before someone else took sannyas, you know, the same fire sacrifice basically. It's just that he came up first to get his danda, that he sat first in the line for prasadam. So you don't really want to be that crazy with the hierarchies, but still, natural, as Krishna says, you know, respecting, offering respects of one's body to one's worshipful superiors. Keep society in order. Okay, any other questions or comments or arguments or problems or issues or disagreements or chaos? No? Anyone want to be like this lady here? Jumping in the fire? No. That can't be imposed, as Prabhupada said. It has to come from the heart. Okay, I guess I'm happy now. All glories to His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.